Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with pianist, studio recording musician, Mike Lang. This is a very special interview with a very special man. And not only do you hear from his own mouth how he became a musician, how he became the particularly diverse musician that he is, but also you get to hear a couple of cuts from his album, which is an homage to Henry Mancini, with whom he worked quite a lot, called Days of Wine and Roses, the classic songs of Henry Mancini. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. That is, being all that you really are. As a psychotherapist who's been in practice for more than 30 years now, I see over and over again that so many of us are hiding pieces of ourselves, aspects of ourselves, skills that we have, ways of thinking, qualities, attributes, that we own them, that we are them, but we're not demonstrating them. And that in many, many cases, we don't even know we have them. People will come to me and say, you know, I'm so shy. It's so hard for me to speak up, to say my mind, to have my voice, to let people know how, what I think and how I feel. You know, I know some people who say, you know, I don't even say whether I like this movie or not until I've heard what other people have said. I'm so reluctant to let people know what I think. And I generally remind these people that the chances are good that when they were an infant, when they were a toddler, they knew very well what they thought and they had no shyness about saying it. If you know a toddler, you know. They say, yes, I want to eat that. No, I don't want to eat that. Yes, I want to wear this. No, I don't want to wear this. Pick me up. Put me down. I'm not going to sleep. they have no reluctance. They're not inhibited. They know what they want, what they think, what they feel, and they are open about it. Like the song from, I think it's South Pacific, right? You have to be carefully taught. We have to be carefully taught not to use these qualities. And it is possible to inhibit children very, very young. I understand that children as young as under two were taught not to cry in Nazi Germany, because of course it would be dangerous for everyone if for those who were hiding to be discovered. So we can be taught not to be ourselves. That's what I see. So these people who come to me and say, I can't tell what I want to need. I don't even know what I want, what I think, what I like, what I need. I know that's not really true. I know they mean it. I know they're telling me the truth. But I believe that they had these qualities and they were carefully taught to hide them. And over time they got so good at hiding them that they forgot they had them. But I do not believe that we can lose ourselves. We can hide ourselves. We can deny ourselves. So the way I talk about this, and you can find me talking about this, by the way, in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. The way I talk about it is I say that those qualities which we are demonstrating today, the ones that we show, the ones that we think of as ourselves, are quite often simply our cover story. You know, like a spy has a cover story, because if he or she would let it be known what they really were, they would be in danger. Well, this is how I see it, that we have created this cover story based on what we learned about what worked and what didn't work. And everything that didn't work relegated to our undercover. We bury it, we hide it, we deny it, but we can't lose it. And that's really the important point, and that's the theme of the Lynn Show, that if there is something that you would want to be, that you are struggling with, that you feel stuck in, the chances are really good you already have it. But it is not so simple as my saying, well, you know, you can get your voice back, you can, you know, with this, oh yeah, yeah, right, you do know what you want, what you think, you can say it, and then you do it. You had very, very good reasons for first pretending, then hiding, then denying, then forgetting that you had these qualities, that you were this thing. And when you start to try and recover these aspects of yourself, the very good reasons that you had for burying them, they come back, and they come back big time. And so they stop you. Still, it's possible. It's work. Of course, that is the work of psychotherapy. And I encourage you to seek out a psychotherapist if you believe that any of this is true for you. The ways in which we can be discouraged are many and varied and person-specific. Not everybody experiences the same kind of discouragement. Although in the end it looks pretty much the same, whether your family didn't like it when you sang out loud, you know, and made a lot of noise with your voice, and they told you that that was unattractive or ugly or you shouldn't do it or punished you even for it. Maybe it was your family of origin. Well, this can also happen to us in school. Unfortunately, teachers who are so capable of making a wonderful, positive difference in the lives of the children they teach. And if you've listened to any of my interviews, you hear it over and over again. Mrs. So-and-so saw something in me. She heard me singing in the choir, and she said to me, wow, you have a terrific voice, and why don't you think about going over here and auditioning for this or trying out for that? Or, wow, you're a good writer. I interviewed a while back a man who remembers in elementary school a teacher telling him that he was a good writer. It took until he was 50 for him to write that book, but he remembered it, he held on to it, and he had that book published, and he can call himself a writer now, although he did many, many other things between elementary school and 50. That teacher made that difference. There's a wonderful interview in which a man tells me that he's playing basketball in front of his house, and the gym teacher happens to be walking by and says, you know, I saw you in that play. You were terrific. This had not occurred to this young boy that he had been terrific in the play, and it turned his entire life around. So teachers can do wonderful things, and do. But they can also discourage, they can also embarrass, they can also criticize. And those of us who had experienced that learn to hide those qualities. I talk a lot about bullying these days because we hear a lot about it. This can happen with peers. This can happen in your religion. Maybe something that you do doesn't go down well in your particular religion. It can happen in your culture. We only have to look at the repression that people experience in some cultures to see how much they must suppress in order to be safe. So there are lots of ways in which we can experience the need to hide ourselves. The Lynn Show is about trying to make the point that if this did happen to you, it is possible to recover what you had to hide, what you had to lose. And life is much better when you have access to all that you are. First of all, it takes energy to suppress this stuff, even though you're not aware of the energy you're spending. And second of all, maybe there's a book you could have written. Maybe there's a song you could be singing. Maybe you could simply be standing up for yourself with your spouse, with your sister, with your best friend, and saying, no, I don't like that, I don't want to do that, I don't want to eat that food, I don't want to go to that movie, I want to go here, I want to do this. And your life can reflect so much more of what you like, what you want, who you are. So that is the point of the Lynn Show. And to make this point, even more than just saying it and encouraging you to explore it, maybe even to read my book, which you can get on my website, by the way, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn. You can find my book, you can find out anything you want to know about me, you can get me to come and talk to your group or organization, you can ask me any questions, just click on contact me. I'll be happy to hear from you. So the other thing that you can get on my website is access to all the shows I've ever done and all the interviews I've ever done, including the one I'm about to play now. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And it is always my hope that you are inspired to recover yourself having heard these people. And Mike Lang, the amazing recording studio musician, is one of these people. When you listen to Mike, you hear a man who is completely in sync with who he is. This was a very long interview, and I didn't want to cut any more of it than I had to, so I've split it into two parts. And this is part one, in which you will hear Mike talk about how he became the musician that he is, his early experiences, and they are very, very interesting. And in addition, I am playing a couple of cuts from his only solo album, Days of Wine and Roses, the classic songs of Henry Mancini. I'm going to start by playing as much as I can of one of the songs, and after the interview, I'm going to play as much as I can of another of the songs. So here now is Mike Lang, playing the Days of Wine and Roses. Thank you. So I'm here with Mike Lane in his really beautiful Studio City house. How long have you been here?
Well, that's a very interesting story. This time,
yes,
I've been in this house for about 32 years.
This time?
When we walked into this house, my wife reminded me that the first thing I said is, I feel comfortable here. I was kind of off on this side of the house, and my wife was in the bedroom, and she said, so your husband's name is Mike Lang, right? And she said, yes. And he said, well, is he any relationship to Jennings Lang? And Karen said, that's his father. He said, well, he built this house in 1941.
Oh, my God.
So I had lived here for 4.5 years.
Oh, my God.
So this is all unrelated to your show.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very clear that you have made your life, certainly, and your living with music.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It was an easy choice because I pretty much sucked at everything else. As a kid, I mean.
Well, that's my question, actually. I only ask one question, and it is, what was the very first hint, inclination, that music would be important to you? What was the first moment that you thought you were drawn to music, that you might music, but not when you decided, okay, I'm going to be a musician, but the earliest.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know?
Well, I can only tell you this. There must have been a piano in our house. When I was 4.5, we moved to Westwood. And that's when I started taking piano lessons. Now, it was reported to me that I asked for them. I don't know that I believe that. But it's a 4.5-year-old asking for piano lessons, it seems a little sophisticated. There must have been a piano there, and somehow there must have been this observation that I was, you know, bonded with this piano in some way. And so what happened was, once I was studying, I think what I found out, being a kid with probably a kid who's shy and not confident and not social particularly, this is where I was comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So you remember that? You remember the sense of being comfortable with the piano?
No, I think I currently experience it as a lifetime condition.
So, sort of in retrospect, you imagine, figure that you must have.
Yeah, my memory is extraordinarily poor in many, many ways. But as we talk, a whole lot of things will come out of my life that you will hear. But it's only because we're in this experience.
Let's just see how much of that early time, the earliest lessons, do you remember any of that?
Yeah, I do. The first woman I studied with, it's funny, she was probably younger than I, or close to being younger than I am now, but I remember her as this matronly, white-haired woman who had two favorite pianists, Jose Iturbe, that was her favorite classical pianist, and her other favorite musician was Liberace. Well, it made for a really auspicious experience for me because she not only had me playing written music, classical music, but she also would bring in popular music and teach me about chord symbols. So she would write them out, like an F major 7, she'd write F-A-C-E. And so I'd learn to play just simple root position voicings in the left hand and play a melody and learn how to maybe improvise. And I remember she put seals on my music, you know, stars and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And she probably was a fairly limited musician in some ways, but it was really a sort of a magical way to start because it set the tone for me being able to be about more than one thing in music. She exposed me to idea of classical music being one music and popular music being something else. And then I do remember by the time I was 9, there was a popular arrangement of The Flight of the Bumblebee called Bumble Boogie, which a guy named Jack Fina did as a recording, I think it was with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. So it was like a, you know, a boogie-woogie with a big band
kind
of thing. And the music was published, and I learned it, and it was sort of my show-off piece, because it had all this bass stuff in the mm-hmm. right hand, you know, this B stuff kind of stuff. So I remember that.
So by the time you were 9, you could already do that?
Well, I could play that piece. It was a completely written piece, but I jazzed it up with glissandos and a couple
you
of
did.
Stupid cheap tricks. I wasn't a show-off, but I just sort of, I don't know, but I think I would be correct in trying to say that I was always interested in making things up. Not being a composer, but I remember I loved Boogie Woogie, so I used to improvise.
How do you define yourself? When people, I mean, if there's anybody you meet who doesn't know what you do or who you are, and they ask you, what do you say?
But I define myself as a musician, a professional musician.
You don't think of yourself as a composer?
I have composed, so it's part of what I do. One of the reasons that I arrived at the career I arrived at was, which was to be a freelance recording musician, is that the diversity of all the things that I've been called upon to do, somehow I got known for being able to do a lot of different kinds of
somehow
music. Yeah, it just happens almost by accident, because when I first started doing recording work, one guy would call me and I'd go to a movie and there'd be two pianists and he'd say, okay, you're the jazz guy, okay, you don't play the classical thing. I said, sure, great. Then, you know, I'd go somewhere else the next day and they'd say, you're the classical guy, you know. So people didn't really have, they knew me more specifically when it started as to be one thing or another thing, and then eventually it's like there was a line that started to connect all of this together. Oh, this guy can actually do more than one.
Right. Okay, so let's go back. So you're 9, and when do you play this? When you get an opportunity to show off, where do you do it?
Probably at night when my father would have somebody over, and because they'd like to put me on display. I was the piano guy.
So did you continue to study the whole time? Did you change from the woman with the white hair?
Yeah, eventually. I don't remember how long I had her, and I think I had some people in between her and the next person I'm going to talk to you about. But when I was 11 mm-hmm. or 12, my father was trying to figure out people that I could, you know, he'd ask around, and he was in the entertainment world, so he had connectivity to music. And so he heard about this composer who had been teaching a lot of talented composers about music, who was an improvising pianist in his early life. His name is George Tremblay. He was born in Ottawa. He was completely crazy and an amazing talent. And he actually came to my house every week and gave me a music lesson, not so much a piano lesson. And he turned me on to everything. He would come in one week and say, what do you know about Bruckner? I'd say, who's Bruckner? He says, okay, we're going to do Bruckner. Mm-hmm. And then the next week he'd come in and say, what do you know about Errol Garner?
Oh.
And so, just for your audience, Anton Bruckner was a really important German composer who was a contemporary of Wagner. He's not so well known to everybody. And Errol Garner, for those of you who don't know, was a masterful, unique jazz pianist too. So anyway, then the third week he'd ask me about Shakespeare. I mean, it really was everything. He just made me so aware of what was out there in the world, in the worlds of art.
What's so interesting about this is that both of the people you've talked about did that. They were they expanded you instead of constricting you.
That's true. Yeah, but especially George, because it was just so.
But it's possible that the first woman, the first teacher, set the stage for this, opened you to the possibilities, mm-hmm. of many different kinds of music.
Well, I think the most important part was the idea of working with chords and being, yeah. Your own person, trying to figure out what to do. You're not playing written music. So that opened the whole idea of playing music without looking at the printed page
right.
as well.
Right. Okay, so how long did you study with George?
3 years.
3 years. So and that makes you like 14, 15.
Right? My birthday is in the end of the year. So I probably was 14, becoming 15. And then my father had this idea that I should go to a private prep school and have this incredible educational experience. It was a very complicated choice because my mother had died when I was 9. And so he had remarried. My relationship with my stepmother was establishing itself. And so it was a difficult decision. I guess I didn't feel like killing the idea because I went. But I was maybe wondering, like, do they want to get rid of me right now? Is this a new married couple kind of doesn't want the stepson issue? And me and my younger brother were the two people at that time. Or is this really going to be good for me to be out on my own? And I think ever since I lost my mother, I became very adult about everything. I wanted to be in control of my own life. So I thought this was important because I felt like I couldn't really be dependent. I just think I would be disappointed. I just think I knew from 9 on, I had to sort of deal with stuff, even if it wasn't very articulate in my mind. And I got an absolutely amazing education, but the music stuff was very limited.
And suddenly you're dropped into this place where you don't know anybody also.
Yeah.
And didn't you say you were a little shy?
Yeah, I was shy, and I had to deal with a demographic of people that weren't so terrific.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
I mean, it was a boys' school.
Right.
It was all New England conservative money and money from Alabama.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of racism that I'd never encountered anti-Semitism. I was one of 6 Jewish people there.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was different.
No, I'm sure it was difficult. And there was no music, or not much music.
No, there was music. Actually, there was a guy named Rolf Itter who taught music in this sort of very restricted way. And I put together a jazz band, which I did, you know, performing with. It's called the Sleepless Nights, with K-N-I-G-H-T-S.
Oh, very clever. So there were other guys who played?
To some extent.
To some extent. So that must have been, because what I was thinking was that you were talking about the piano as a place of comfort, and that you probably needed it in this context.
Well, also, keep in mind that I probably spent X number of hours just by myself at the piano. You know, I don't know how much, because the education was such that you were in class a lot, and the amount of homework was twice as much time as the classroom. When I got to the University of Michigan, because of the kind of rigorous education I had, I could sleep through the whole thing in 2 days. It was so easy.
That must have been a great relief.
It was. I went to the movies a lot.
Oh, yeah. So what I find myself wondering is, where in this trajectory did it begin to occur to you that you would want to make a life of music, that you would want to, that's what you would want to be?
I think I probably knew it, because I wasn't literally doing anything else. I mean, that's all I was doing was music.
So you were doing your studies, but...
I discovered girls and stuff, but I wasn't a sports person at all.
Right.
In fact, my father, who's a huge sports fan, would take me to baseball games 3 times a week. So the first time I was there, and somebody hit a home run, and I was just amazed, you know. And then the next time somebody hit a home run, my father said, see? I said, well, I already saw that. And it was like, it wasn't interesting to me. I would zone out with the roar of the crowd and be in my own place when I went to these ball games.
Wow.
So now transposed into the future, when my father finally had time to visit me for the first time at the University of Michigan when I was in my junior year. First thing he wanted to see was the football stadium, because it's very famous. And I had no idea where it was. I never went to a sporting event at the University of Michigan. I was just in my own world. And here's a man who was working in the motion picture industry, started as an agent, became an executive at Universal, ran the television department, and then became like third in command of, you know, the guy who worked right under Lou Wasserman, producing in-house movies. And he worked with film composers, and so, he had this, you know, connection to the arts.
Right.
I know that he would go to, like, with my stepmother, they were founders at the Philharmonic, and they go down, they have these great seats. My father would always have an earpiece listening to a ball game while he was watching a concert. I don't know how he pulled that off. But.
What an interesting guy your father was. But it must have been somewhat complicated anyway for him to have created you.
Well, yeah, and he was ambitious for me. He really wanted me to be a composer more than be, you know, an instrumentalist.
Player.
Well, yeah, a player doing what I was doing. I mean, he was very proud of me, but he would brag to everybody else. He wouldn't really talk to me at that level.
No, though a lot of people do that.
He once actually said to me that one of his fears was that I was going to be more successful than him.
Oy.
Yeah. So you're dealing with...
Yeah, right.
He said it.
Right.
He could actually say it.
That is amazing.
But what he didn't calculate is how hurtful that would be, and that he maybe shouldn't have said it.
Right.
He said, is that all you want to be in town, best piano player?
Ooh.
And I said, well, if I am the best piano player, you're not the best person at what you do in Hollywood.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, you're very successful. But I said, you're not a director. You don't make movies. You just basically comment on other people's work and try and bring things in on budget. And you know, the bottom line is, through all of this, I knew I had to figure out a lot for myself.
Yes.
Well, like, to pick up from the history, when I graduated, you know, you asked me, when did I know I was going to be in music? Well, I knew, I think I was going to be in music in somehow, but I mean, it wasn't even a formed thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when I got out of college, then I knew you know, that I needed to figure stuff out. And when I came home, and my parents now were living in a mansion in Beverly Hills, and I had my own room over the garage with a separate entrance, like a bachelor pad kind of situation. It was really quite ideal. It was kind of a large space. And I remember my father calling me on the intercom, and he decided that I should do some domestic chore at that moment. And I actually had been hired by a record producer to write a string quartet arrangement for a pop record, and I'd never written anything like that in my life, and I had to do it that night. And he's like on the intercom with me, and I said, I really can't do it. I have something I have to do. And he says, well, if you're going to live here, you have to, you know, do your fair share. And I said, are you saying I have to do it tonight? He said, yes. And I said, well, you know what? I'll make arrangements to live elsewhere. I'm not going to do it. And that was it. I left.
Wow.
But I just want to go back to the fact that when I came back to Los Angeles, I was thinking about my main involvement with music at that point was jazz. So I was trying to figure out if I could have a life as a jazz performer. And what I felt about it was, over a period of years, formative years in L.A., I felt like, you know, I'm not going to get to work with Miles Davis or John Coltrane. I'm not going to be able to launch a career by working with one of these superstars. I'd have to go to New York, and maybe it wouldn't happen anyway. So if I play with these local bands that I'm playing with and making records with them, so they're prominent, it's not going to lead to the launch of a very strong career. And unless I become one of the top three pianists in my field, I'm going to be living in motels and playing nightclubs all over the place.
Right.
And play, you know, occasionally play festivals, but not have a high income. And I thought, you know, I really would love to figure out a way to be in music and not have that lifestyle. And that's when I sort of heard about this phenomenon of freelance musicians who worked in Los Angeles. And then I kind of understood how well-paying it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I also understood how you would get to do something fresh every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, at that point, traveling with a jazz band that Paul Horn had, and we did these trips that were kind of crazy, and we played the same music every night. And I thought, it's not really what I want to do. I'm much happier living in L.A., having my own life, and so that's how I got into the music world and really figured out where I thought I belonged.
Well, and you were able to do everything, it seems to me. You were able to make a terrific living. You were able to be with really accomplished, you know, musicians all the time. You were able to do different things all the time. I mean, it's really kind of perfect, don't you think?
It is. It's been a, I've been a lucky guy. Because, you know, at that time, there was a lot of work, so there were many more musicians working. But the truth is, even with all of that work, you know, if you're a violinist, there's lots of violins in an orchestra. There's only one or two or maybe three keyboard players.
That's right.
So, you know, after you figure about the six top people who get the first opportunities to have work, there's not much work for a lot of other people.
That's right.
So just to be one of those people, it's not just being a good musician. There are lots of great musicians.
So what
but
is it?
I think you have to have people skills. I think you have to know how to make people feel like they want you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not saying that I was a real politically manipulative kind of person, but I love people, and I love creative people, and I love talented people. So if I'm working for someone who's really gifted, it's really easy for me to be turned on and have some kind of communication go on. And it always seemed to work. I mean, it wasn't just having good working relationships. I had friendships with many of the people I worked for.
You know, forgive me, but you're kind of a, for me anyway, given your background, given your history, your father, and the fact that your mother died, and the fact that you were shy, and that the piano became this place of comfort for you, and that you go off to this school where you don't know anybody and everybody is not like you, that kind of background doesn't necessarily lead to the kind of guy you just described, who really likes people, who's comfortable with them, who creates friendships and intimacy. There's something else in you. Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't think that you're the same person through life. You evolve and you start through self-discovery. You figure out who you are and what's possible. You know, I'm still doing it. Yeah, I actually had something happen about 3 years ago, I'd like to call it an epiphany, for lack of a better word. It's just like, it was like a toggle switch that was in the off position, and I turned it to the on position. It changed everything. It's just like, if you're the kind of person who meets someone and you tend to look at the things that bug you about that person,
right?
That was extending into certain areas of my life where I identified it. You know, like playing the piano, I would go play an instrument, and I immediately figure everything about the instrument that was deficient. It even got to the point once where I was working with Henry Mancini on a movie, and there was a solo piano melody to be played over the strings. And when I played it, I noticed how uneven the notes were, and some would be louder, some would be softer, some would decay faster. So I actually put a dynamic on each note. So if I play this note piano, and this one mezzo forte, and this one forte, it'll all sound
it'll
mezzo
be even.
Forte.
Wow.
And I did it, and when I did it, I sort of thought, yeah, this is one way to do it. But I think at the point when all this changed, I realized, like, this isn't a good way to make music. Mm-hmm. And now what happens with pianos is, it's like with people too, I try and figure out what I like, and I try and make it as intuitive and unintellectual an experience as I can.
Yes.
And so very often somebody will ask me what the piano was like where I played, and I won't have any memory of the instrument, but I'll have memory of what was inside of me and how this invisible thing produced it.
Yes, yes.
And that's kind of the way I like to think of instruments, although, you know, I love really good pianos, and they do make a difference. Mm-hmm. It's nice when they're tuned and all that kind of thing. But if one is really bad, then I have to think about it because it's so
right.
severe. I have to make
you have
something.
To compensate for
I
it.
I have to do something. But it just became sort of an operative for everything that I do. It's an operative for what kind of choices I make, and in music, those choices can be creative. And so I just try to figure out, what's my role here? What can I do? It's like an acting job in a way. It's like, who am I today?
Wow. So it makes you so flexible.
Yeah, but I, as a musician, for me, I live in the present tense. I'm not an improvising musician like an Oscar Peterson who has all of these rehearsed, incredible arrangements and everything is pretty worked out. He's improvising, but he's improvising with massive structure. Massive things of practicing jazz licks, and even though they come out differently all the time, his vocabulary is extraordinarily set.
Yes.
I went through a period of that. He was a really big influence on me when I was younger because I loved the way he swung so hard and was just so visceral, you know. But I'm a different person now. I sit down and it's like I want to play as if I'm playing for the first time or the last time or both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like I once said to somebody, I always think when I go to work for somebody else that it's an opportunity, so it's a beginning, and I also fear that it could be the last time. So this combination gives me a balance of wanting to make it always. I never want to become complacent or like, you know, yeah, I know how to do this, I got this sculled out. I don't want it to be about that. I want it to be about like what can happen.
Yeah.
And often it's not so intellectual. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's very clever and intellectual. But when it's not, when it's intuitive, it's sometimes the best way for it to be.
I'll bet. And I'll bet it feels terrific.
Yeah, but there are times when, you know, I always say that the magic kind of passes through you, and your job is not to interrupt it. Because you don't know where it comes from. It's like you're observing this music pass through you.
Yeah.
And you don't want to impose something, because as soon as you impose something, you destroy that energy, and it takes you to some other place that interferes.
See,
and there are other days when nothing is happening, so you need to know how to function when nothing is happening.
Because you have the skill. You can do that in any case, right?
The last time I was in the studio, something came up where I had to play after having been in the booth all day kind of supervising. Then I had to go out and do these tracks with just voice and piano. And I really felt disoriented. And I really didn't like the experience when I was doing it. I really thought it was bad.
Mm.
I didn't like it at all. I doubted it.
And then you heard it.
Then we heard it, and I still wasn't sure. And I called the artist the next day, because she's paying for it. It's her project and everything.
Right.
And I said, how were those tracks we did? How was the piano? Because I was just redo the vocals. I said, how were the tracks? She said they were great, you know, and I said, I needed to ask because I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm very sure of what I think my level of performance is, And most of the time, I'm not one to leap up and down right away. You know, it's like the one album that I did, which I'm going to give you, and where I did spend actually a lot of time writing arrangements. This is an album of Henry Mancini's music, and half of it's with a piano trio and half of it's solo piano. And I just thought, and Karen and I talked about it, my wife and I, and it's like, if you're going to record something as well known as Moon River, you nearly need to come to some conclusion about what that song means to you and what you want to, you know, do with it. You don't want to just leave it up to chance. So given that mindset, I spent 3 weeks and wrote very, very intensive arrangements. They still were more about a catalyst for improvisation than a lot of written material, but harmonies were, you know, really worked out and sometimes altered to present something different about the song and the character of the style of each song, things like that. So when I went into the studio, I actually had a safety net that was mm-hmm. different than what I'm usually used to. And it worked out really well, but it took me a long time to realize that the album was any good.
Why?
I don't know why.
Well, no, I'm not asking a different question. What happened? When did you decide that it was good? Do you remember that?
I think it was a gradual process because as time passed, I could listen to it and not feel like I was the person who was doing the playing. I could listen to it just as a piece of music and say, what does this guy sound like?
Yeah.
And then I thought, yeah, it's pretty good.
That must feel good.
Yeah, it does. But I want to keep going, so.
Keep going, meaning you want to keep doing more stuff.
Yeah, I want to keep making music, so I don't want to dwell on, you know, I'm not a fan, I'm a musician. I mean, I am a fan, but in my own life as a musician, I need to be going along in the present tense.
So
I don't want to be some elderly guy saying, hey, I did this in 1930, you know, I did this in 1940. No, it's like, what am I going to do today?
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, it's all the same stuff. It's the being in the moment for you, you know, and I'm...
I like the present, and I like the future, and the past is great, but it interrupts time for the other two tenses.
Do you want to say that again?
Sure. For me, it's the present and the future that I want to direct my attention mm-hmm. to, and the past is wonderful, and the past gives us a premise for things that can come after, but the past can also interrupt your ability to spend time in these other two tenses, which I think is... It's more preferable.
I love that, and I've never heard anybody describe it in quite that way, that the past can interrupt the other two tenses. I think that's absolutely right.
And well, I mean, if you're sitting around re-experiencing the past, and that's a wonderful thing for some people to do, for me, I prefer what I'm doing with you now, and what is it that I'm going to do when we're done.
Right. No, I think that's wonderful, and I just never heard anybody describe it in quite that way.
I've never... thought about it and never said it.
No, but well, again, thank you very much.
Well, that's the present tense.
That's,
you know?
Exactly right. That's right. We are here in the present discovering as we speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you discovered that there was a career in being a freelance musician in Los Angeles, and you found a way into that somehow. Do you remember how you did that?
Yeah.
So, are you intrigued? I know I was. I was very curious to hear how this gentleman was going to turn the skills that he had acquired to this point into the career that I know that he had. So if you are curious, you can hear about that next week when I play part two of my interview with the extraordinary and yet understated Mike Lang, the Mike Lang who is so capable of living in the present. I found that so fascinating, and of course, everything he says confirms what I know about people who make their living or their life with an art, and that is that that is who they are. So I'm going to close the show here, and we're going to go out on yet another wonderful cut from Mike's solo CD, Days of Wine and Roses, and this, of course, is the classic Moon River. So, I am hoping, as always, that you got something you can use from this show. Something that you learned that you didn't know. Something that inspired or intrigued you. Something of which you were curious. Or maybe, as I like to say, whenever I play these wonderful examples of the virtuosity of the people that I interview, that you simply sit back and enjoy listening to Mike's very specific and unique vision of Henry Mancini's Days of Wine and Roses. And I hope that one of those things is going to bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with the wind.